you for the warm. That wasn't the word I was going to say, but probably the best choice. Good, so I'm going to tell you about some stuff I've been doing with Tassos Petru from Crete. And this is a project that's been running for a long time. This is the latest incarnation, I guess. And Nam is my student in Ravenna. The basic focus is to tell you about some ABS-CFT stuff we've been doing in the particular case of asymptotic ABS-4 geometries. And as you know, there's a fairly long history of studies of ABS-4. It's certainly not as well developed as the ABS-5 case for a variety of reasons. Most important, of course, is that in the ABS-5 case, the dual field theory is a simple Yang-Mills theory. As you also know, the simplest example of an ABS-4 geometry comes from the near horizon geometry of M2 brains. And that one certainly is not a Yang-Mills theory. For example, the free energy scales has n to the 3/2. Recently, of course, there's been a proposal by Wagner and Lambert and others for what this boundary theory may be. And that is not what I'm going to talk about today. Instead, I'm going to take a much simpler view where it's sort of a design. I like to think of it as sort of a designer view where we just think about having some asymptotically ABS-4 geometry with some sorts of fields propagating on that geometry. And we just simply carry over the usual holographic dictionary and the tools that we have from holography. And we see what we get. And there's been lots of interest in this sort of approach recently. For example, there are many examples which are believed to have something to do with condensed matter systems. So there are proposals for simple bulk physics that corresponds to superfluids or superconductors. There are other cases where, which I'm also not going to talk about at all, there are other cases in which you can talk about geometries which are in fact not asymptotically ABS. They have some other asymptotic symmetry group. And for example, you can use this work about non-relativistic field theories. The basic interest in this sort of approach is that you can use holography not to go from the bulk to the boundary, but rather from the boundary to the bulk in the sense that you can compute interesting quantities such as transport coefficients in three-dimensional field theories that are of interest to condensed matter. And in some cases, this might be the only way you have of computing those reliably. Anyway, in any case, it's interesting to explore the possibilities, and I'm going to tell you about one such case today. And as I go through the talk, you'll see that there are several different aspects of it. There's one aspect which is, from the boundary point of view, we find a solution which has an interesting boundary interpretation in the field theory on the boundary. But there's also an interesting, we're sort of having fun with an interesting bulk interpretation, which gives us sort of an analog to, it's not equivalent to, but it's an analog to superconductors in condensed matter. Not in the sense that I was speaking of here, where you have a superconductor boundary, but where we use it as an analog to think about the physics in the bulk. Okay. So I guess I'm gonna warm up by talking about some older work, and mostly I think this is just to set the stage and set the notation. But one of the earliest proposals for a theory of this type, something that's asymptotically ABS-4, was given by a long time ago by Klebanov and Polyakov, and they just suggested that if you consider a scalar field propagating on ABS-4 with the mass squared equal to -2 in ABS units, that corresponds to an to operators in the boundary of dimension 1 and 2. And this is an example where you're in the mass window where both of the asymptotic modes are normalizable. And because of that, there's a lot of interesting structure involved here. And in the particular case of Klebanov and Polyakov, the proposal was that the boundary theory that this situation is dual to is just the large N O(n) model, which is known from large N analysis in the field theory case to have a number of, well, actually two, large N fixed points. And the story goes that there's a so-called double trace deformation that leads you, a double trace deformation in the boundary theory that leads you from one of these fixed points to the other. And this whole structure, the fact that you have, I don't know if you can read this, I'm plotting dimension versus spin here. This structure that you have for the scalar field of having two modes that are normalizable actually extends to higher spin fields as well. First of all, the gauge fields, but also gravitons, et cetera. And there's a conjecture here that if you look at any of these cases related to this double trace business in a certain way, there's a generalization of what we know as electromagnetic duality in the bulk. The bulk is four-dimensional, and we can talk about electromagnetic duality in the Maxwell theory, for example. And then there's a generalization of that to all of these higher spin fields. And it has a particular manifestation in the boundary theory. So let me expand on that a little bit. And again, this is mostly the set notation. I'm sure you all know about electromagnetic duality. So here's the Maxwell theory. And I've written it in sort of a Hamiltonian form in the first line, where I write, so you're supposed to think of this action as being like PQ dot minus the Hamiltonian. And indeed, the first term, A is the gauge field, E is its conjugate momentum, so that's the kinetic term, there's the Hamiltonian. And lastly, there's a constraint term, which just enforces the Gauss constraint, as usual. And I've written it in the following way. So normally, so this is just FB mu squared, but I've written it in a form in which E and B are one forms. Okay, so I've used the Hodge dual to write B as a one form, for example. Okay. And then, so the idea is that if I write it in that particular form, then electromagnetic duality is very simple. It just interchanges E and B in the usual way. And if I map, if in addition to that I map the gauge field to a dual gauge field that I call A dual here, we end up with a similar looking action in terms of the dual fields. And the difference between these actions is in fact just a boundary term. It looks like a sort of a Chern-Simons coupling between the gauge field and its dual. And in addition to this mapping of the fields, you can check, and it's obvious in this theory, that the Bianchi identity and the Gauss law are just interchanged. The constraint and the Bianchi identity are just interchanged when you do this duality. So the interpretation here is that this electromagnetic duality gives you a canonical transformation. Canonical transformations are generated by boundary terms. Okay, and that boundary term involves the boundary values of the bulk fields. Okay, so one of the points of this discussion is that modification of the boundary leads then to a modification of boundary correlation functions. And in fact, this duality, this sort of Z2 duality that I discussed here, extends to an entire SL2, which you can show acts on the current correlators of the boundary theory. Okay, so what I was saying earlier was that this structure, in fact, generalizes to higher spins. So again, just mostly to set up notation, let me just show you how that works. Eventually, in this talk, what I'm going to be focusing on is the introduction of torsion. And so for that reason, it's convenient to write things in the first order formalism, as we'll see. And so what I'm writing here is just the usual Einstein-Hilbert action, you know, root gr minus lambda root g, but I've written it in terms of the Vilmaian E and the spin connection for which omega, for which r is the curvature two form. Okay. And there's a torsion two form as well, which is sort of like a covariant derivative of the Vilmaian in this notation. And the idea here is that this theory, at least classically, is equivalent to general relativity. But in this formalism, what we do is instead of just setting the torsion to zero, as we would if we were taking the Levi-Civita connection in the metric formalism, instead what we do is we vary the Vilmaian and connection independently. And then the equations of motion in the vacuum just set, well, just involve the curvature and the cosmological constant. And the second equation of motion just sets the torsion to zero. Okay, oops. Okay, so the first thing I want to do is I just want, again, to set notation. I want to just rewrite that theory in a form that looks much like I did for the Maxwell theory. And in order to do that, what I'll do is a 3 plus 1 split, but the 1 here is the radial direction. For example, if I was in ADS, it would be the radial coordinate in ADS. And then, well, so what I'm writing here is essentially the same as the ADM formalism, but written in this form language and written in the case where I'm talking about the radial direction rather than a time-like direction. Okay. So what happens is that the components of the spin connection and the Vilmaian break up like this. And so again, t is the radial coordinate. And what happens is that all of the components proportional to dt turn out to be Lagrange multipliers. And the remaining pieces, which are forms in the transverse directions, are the propagating fields. And in particular here, the extrinsic curvature appears in this component of the spin connection. It's the extrinsic curvature written as a vector value one form, okay, which is maybe different than normal. Okay, in addition, there's a field here which I've called B, and I'll have more to say about that in a moment. But if you just evaluate the Einstein-Hilbert action, and here I'm also including the Gibbons Hawking term, which modifies the boundary, which gives a boundary term to modify the dynamics of that. What you find is an action which has the same sort of form as the Maxwell theory did. There's a kinetic term here. If you interpret the E as the sort of canonical coordinate, the analog of the gauge field in the Maxwell theory, then this looks like PQ dot, where the momentum, as usual, is proportional to the extrinsic curvature. And if you write this out in components, it's just the usual. Once you solve the constraints, it looks the same as in the usual metric formalism. And then everything else is constraints. Okay, there's the Hamiltonian constraint, there's the lapse in the shift, and there's also a couple of other constraints which are there because we haven't gotten rid of the torsion. Okay, so again, the interpretation here is that at least with the addition of the Gibbons Hawking term, the Vilmaian, or at least the components, the transverse components are sort of the canonical coordinates, the extrinsic curvature is the momentum. And this quantity that I call B is actually determinant in terms of these other fields. And in fact, These are the analogs of the gauge field, the electric field, and the magnetic field in the Maxwell theory. In fact, this is why I call that B. Okay, to see that, and in fact, to see a version of electromagnetic duality, what one can do is expand that action around ADS4. Okay, so just consider fluctuations, linearized fluctuations around ADS4, write out the action to quadratic order, and what you find is a term that looks like a kinetic term, a term which looks like a Hamiltonian, and then some constraints, which I haven't bothered to write here. And because of the form of the Hamiltonian, right, it looks like it's the analog of B squared plus B squared, this theory also possesses a version of electromagnetic duality, where now what I'm doing is I'm exchanging K and B rather than B and B, as we did in the Maxwell theory. And you can check that the linearized constraints and the linearized Bianchi identities also get interchanged here. Okay, and so there's it's true only at the linearized level, but this, it's the analog of the electromagnetic duality, and it induces, this transformation induces a canonical transformation, induces a boundary term, which changes the details of the boundary theory. And again, there's a duality action on current-current correlators in the boundary. But now we're talking about spin 2 field, so the currents that I'm talking about here is in fact the stress energy tensor. Okay, so let me change gears. I'm gonna, as I said earlier, what I actually wanted to do mostly in this talk was to talk about introducing torsion into this system, and to, you know, to see what happens basically, and what we'll end up finding is an exact solution in certain cases. So here's how I'm going to do it. It turns out that there are a number of, first of all, the thing that we've seen in the discussion so far is that in the first order formalism, there are actually more variables present than there is in the than there are in the metric formalism, because as I showed you, the torsion constraint comes as an equation of motion. So you might ask, well, can I couple to those degrees of freedom? And in particular, could I couple to the torsion and perhaps find situations where the torsion doesn't vanish by an equation of motion? And the answer is yes. And one way to do that, or at least to build towards doing that, is to consider the following construction. The idea here is let's just start with the fields that we have. So we'll start with the Vilbein and the curvatures, the curvature and the torsion. And we'll just build an action which is SO3-1 invariant. Okay, so we just need to contract all of the indices. And there are a number of things that you can do. These things, of course, are very familiar to the quantum gravity people. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on the first one, which is called the Ni-Yon class, or the Ni-Yon term. It's constructed out of the torsion and the curvature. And in fact, it's a total derivative. Okay, it's a total derivative involving the torsion. And the same is true for the Pontryagin term, trace of R squared, can also be written. Or that's closer to the Yang-Mills situation, where trace of F wedge F can be written as D of a Chern-Simons operator. And in fact, this can also be interpreted as a sort of Chern-Simons operator. If we think of the torsion as the curvature of the Vilbein, then this is sort of the form A wedge dA, or a non-abelian generalization. Okay, so as I said, I'm going to focus on this Ni-Yon term. And well, the fact that this is a total derivative involving a Chern-Simons-like coupling, what that implies is that the coefficient that I'm calling theta here is like a theta angle. It's sort of the analog of the theta angle in Yang-Mills. And so let's push that idea a little bit further. And let me begin by just thinking of theta as a constant. It really is just like the theta angle. And if you add this to the action that I showed you previously, and you work out this 3+1 split that I constructed, what you find is that the conjugate momentum is shifted by the first thing you find is that the conjugate momentum is shifted by something proportional to theta. And also there's a term which starts to look like a kinetic term for B. And remember, before, B was not a dynamical field. It was just determined in terms of the other fields. So in fact, if you think about K, remember K and B are like the electric and magnetic fields. And this is just completely analogous to what's often called the Witten effect in Yang-Mills. If you add a theta angle to Yang-Mills, you'll find that the conjugate momentum is no longer the electric field, but it gets shifted by the magnetic field like this. Okay, so this really does look a lot like an ordinary theta angle. Now, because this is a total derivative and because theta is a constant, this of course, the equation of motion of this theory still gives you zero torsion, right? Because the neon term is a boundary term, so it doesn't modify the equations of motion. And so you can still think of E and K as the canonical variables. Okay, but by adding that term, since it's a boundary term, we modified the boundary. And in fact, for example, there's boundary variation. The on-shell variation of the action involves a new term, so it changes the boundary conditions. Okay, so now, given that, let me promote theta to be a field. Okay, and we'll move it inside the integral. Okay, now that neon term is no longer a total derivative. And theta then is like an axion field, so I'll call it the neon axion. And what I'm going to do to proceed is modify the action that I wrote previously by a boundary term. And the reason I want to do that is I want to modify the canonical structure such that this field, which I guess I'm calling capital theta now, is a canonical coordinate. Okay, so I've just added a total derivative. And written this neon coupling in this way. Okay, and what happens now is that if you vary the action, the torsion is no longer zero, but it's sourced in this way by the derivative of this axion field. And again, that's completely analogous to Yang Mills. Okay, well, you might wonder why I'm writing the theory in this way. In fact, there are other ways we can write the theory. There's at least two other ways. One way to rewrite this theory, is instead of talking about the torsion, a torsional connection, we can split off a torsion-free part of the connection from a connection where the torsion lives. And then it turns out that you can rewrite the action by using the equation of motion. You can rewrite the action as a gravity action involving a Lebesgue-Vita connection plus an additional term, which just looks like the kinetic term for a scalar field theta. And so this scalar field, well, actually it's a pseudo-scalar field. It's very important in what will follow. It's a pseudo-scalar field and it's massless. Okay, so that's one way to rewrite this, and at the classical level, it's completely equivalent. Another way that you can rewrite this theory, which is perhaps more familiar from the string theory point of view, is that you can rewrite it in terms of a Kalman-Ramon field, or in terms of an antisymmetric tensor field. And the way that goes is that you just write start and theta, which is a three-form, as H, okay, the derivative of a two-form field, which I'm calling C here. And if you work out the equation of the action, then you find that it's just torsionless gravity coupled to H wedge star H plus, as it turns out, a boundary term. Okay, so you could use any of these formalisms. As I said, this is perhaps the most familiar one, but I'm going to proceed with this torsional formalism, and actually, pretty soon I'm just going to look at solutions of the equation of motion now, so it doesn't really matter which formalism I'm using once I reduce to the equations of motion. Okay, so. So as I said, so let me go back now and rewrite the action in this 3 plus 1 split formalism. And this is what you get when you do that. Okay. There's a modification of there's an apparent modification of the canonical momentum here. There's a kinetic term for theta, right? And the conjugate momentum to theta is proportional to the torsion. And then there are also, of course, constraints, which I won't bother to write. But the constraints are modified by the presence of theta. OK. Now, to proceed, I'm just going to look at a particular solution. So I'm going to make an ansatz, a very simple ansatz. And what we'll find is that in a particular case, there's an exact solution that's not too hard to find. Okay, so I'm just going to take an ansatz where the fields only depend upon the radial coordinate. Remember, I'm calling that radial coordinate t here. Okay, so I parameterize in terms of an unknown function a of t. And it turns out that you can solve all of the constraints if you take the extrinsic curvature and this magnetic field to be of this form, where k and b are, it turns out, the momenta conjugate to a and theta, respectively. Okay, so then if you just crank through and solve for the equations of motion, it turns out they look like this. And one of the things I forgot to mention is that you may have seen factors of sigma appearing in various equations. Sigma is this, what I've done is just formulate this in an arbitrary signature. So sigma is the overall signature of the four-dimensional space time here. Okay, so in ordinary ADS, then sigma would be, in fact, minus one. Now, on the other hand, if I go to Euclidean signature, okay, so if I whip rotate the time-like boundary direction, then it turns out that there's an exact solution which looks as follows. And what's happening here is that the theta field has a kink profile. I've drawn it in red here. Okay, it starts at some value given by theta naught and shifts in the normalization that I've used here by 2 pi as you go from t equals minus infinity to t equals plus infinity. Okay, and the metric, I guess what I plotted there in the blue dashed curve, is e to the a of t. It's just a power of a hyperbolic cosine, and so it gets large both as t goes to plus infinity, but also as t goes to minus infinity. Okay, so what that means is that the solution, in fact, is asymptotically ADS in both regimes. So if I compare that to ADS in these coordinates, ADS would be such that, well, the metric gets large in these coordinates as t goes to plus infinity, but it gets small as you go to t equals minus infinity. Okay, and as I said, in addition to that, the pseudoscalar field theta is kinked. And if we relate that back to the torsion or to the H3 field, the change in theta as you go from one end to the other, I normalize things so that that's 2 pi, and that can be written as an integral of H. Okay, so that, I've taken star of H, right? So that's a one form, and the solution is such H has all of its legs in the transverse direction, so star H is just proportional to dt, so that's just it's essentially just dt theta dot, which is where that comes from, on the solution. Okay, so this solution, you can check, is non-singular everywhere. You can compute the curvature. I didn't write it down, but you can compute the curvature, and it's non-singular everywhere. And this solution, by the way, is the name of this, I'll give it, is a torsion vortex. The word vortex is a little bit confusing. It's sort of a historical name for things like this. You might have wanted to call this a torsion kink because of this profile. But in any case, with apologies, I'll continue to call this a torsion vortex. And as I'll show you towards the end of the talk, I'll have sort of a reason to call it, or at least I'll have an analog where this really is, it's analogous to a vortex, let's say that. Okay, well, if you look at so there's several properties of this. As I said, it's non-singular. And in fact, if you look at the Riemann tensor of this solution, you'll find that at the core of the vortex, okay, so as I've drawn it here, at t equals 0, the transverse slices are just flat. Okay, I should have mentioned there's a number of parameters in this solution. There's t0, which is just the position of the core. Okay, there's theta naught, which is the initial height of the pseudoscalar field. And there's a third parameter, all of these are just integration constants. There's a third parameter, alpha, whose importance we'll see later, but it's essentially the height here.
Just to check if I can translate this into language a little more easily. So you're telling us that there's no Birkhoff theorem in ABS for the pseudoscalar field in the other language, is that right?
Can you remind me what Birkhoff's theorem?
So once you impose a spherical symmetry, basically something which is basically like a black hole that are the only solutions which are allowed.
Let's see. So how do I get out of that? So this is Euclidean, first of all, which probably...
I don't think it'll be a bubble, it'll be a black hole.
Yeah. Well, it's a solution, so it...
does it have finite energy or...?
Oh, it has finite energy in a way I'll tell you. No.
Since you've been interrupted. One way of thinking of this was it was gravity coupled with a pseudoscalar in a special way.
Yes.
That kind of sounds, or is it at all related to the instantons? I mean, you might stick the instantons in Euclidean ADF. I guess this is in the spoiler. Well, maybe that's a topic.
It's something I hadn't thought of. So.
Wouldn't that be one thing? Oh, this is the useful. So just trying to have a picture of the geometry. So can I think about, say, two, four balls, and then try to connect the center of the two, four balls by four, so by vortex?
Is there a chalk here? So, there's several different ways to think about this, but the way I tend to think about this is that there are two asymptotic regions here, and they're connected. So you might draw it sort of like that. Okay, so this is the t direction. Okay, so let me leave it at that for a moment, and I'll come back to that. Okay, now if you compute the energy of this solution, it diverges, but it's also true that if you compute the energy of ADS, that diverges as well. And in ADS, it's well known how to cure that. You just need to add a boundary counter term to cancel that divergence. And then in some sense, ADS could be said to have zero energy. In this case, as I said, the energy diverges. But if you add exactly the same counter term as we did for ADS here on both asymptotia, then you find, sort of remarkably, that the energy is exactly canceled. So in precisely the same way as ADS has zero energy, this solution also has zero energy. Yeah.
What an energy.
So I just mean that I'm evaluating the on-shell action.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's think about the holographic interpretation of this. Now this is a little bit unusual because ordinarily when we think about holography, we just have a single boundary to worry about. And there's some sort of holographic RG interpretation of moving along the radial direction. Okay, now I have two boundaries to worry about, and it's not quite clear what holographic RG would mean in that case. But anyway, let's just proceed and expand the solutions asymptotically. So here's simultaneous expansion at both ends. And the first thing that you can see, so I'm writing this in terms of the Dillon, but it's not hard to convert this into the metric, which is more familiar. And let me just point to the fact that a term that goes for the Dillon that goes like e to the plus or minus 3at would have an interpretation that its coefficient is the one-point function of the stress tensor on the boundary. Okay, so here's the asymptotic expansion of this exact solution, and you just see that term is missing. So the interpretation is that the BEV of the stress tensor is zero on the boundaries. Okay, the pseudoscalar, on the other hand, behaves as follows. In On the left limit, you find that it begins as e to the minus 3at, with a coefficient that in the units that I'm, in the normalization of the field that I'm using is plus 4. And in the other regime, theta has a constant piece. Remember, it was a kink. So the constant piece has changed from 0 to 2 pi. And the subleading term, which is analogous to this term, since I'm going to t equals plus infinity instead of t equals minus infinity, I think I might have some sign errors. Anyway, this term, the point, okay, so the point is that this has the opposite sign as it did here, and the coefficients here, remember I'm talking about a massless pseudoscalar field, so if you do the arithmetic, you'll find that that should be, you'd expect that to be dual to a delta equals 3 parity odd operator, because I'm talking about a pseudoscalar, and the one-point function of that operator is just given by these coefficients if you work through the details. Okay, so I don't know what the boundary theory is, but it looks like I have a dimension 3 operator, which is parity odd, and on these two, in these two asymptotic regions, it has a vev, it has a one-point function of opposite sign. And the coupling of that dimension 3 operator, just the coefficient of that operator, is going from 0 to 2 pi as we go from one boundary to the other. Okay, this is an operator that is a pseudoscalar. Okay, it's parity odd, so the fact that it has a vev on either side means that the field theory, whatever it is in a parity breaking vacuum on both sides. And of course, I can't really say what that boundary theory is, but and we've just seen essentially all that I know about this boundary theory. But we do know, as I said, that it has apparently has distinct parity breaking vacua. And let me just give you a simple toy model of a field theory, which seems to capture all of those features, which is simply the Gross-Naveau model, the large M. Okay, so it's the three-dimensional Gross-Naveau model, right? Which is of course just a bunch of fermions with a quartic coupling. And the large M, I'll couple it to a Maxwell field. So the way to proceed here to study that model at large n is to do a Hubbard-Chodorkovich transformation, in other words, split up this quartic potential into a cubic coupling between of the form sigma fermion fermion plus a sigma squared term. Okay, and what that does for you is it gives you a theory which is quadratic, which is Gaussian in the fermions, and the fermions can be integrated out, and you end up with an effective theory of sigma, and you can study the phase structure in the theory by studying that theory. And as I said, in addition, I've coupled to a gauge field here, which I'm just thinking of as a background field. Okay, so what you find when you do that in this case is that there are in fact two large N fixed points in which sigma has a vev of opposite sign. So M is just some is just some appropriate quantity. But the point is that there are two vacua with opposite sign for sigma. Sigma as constructed is a pseudoscalar because psi bar psi in three dimensions is parity odd. This is a mass term in three dimensions is parity odd. Okay, and in addition, okay, so if I then expand the theory around one or the other of those vacuum states, integrate out the fermions, and write an effective action for the gauge field in one or the other of those vacua, it's sort of a famous result that what you end up with is the Chern-Simons term for the gauge field. Okay, that's allowed to appear because the vacuum has broken parity, and the Chern-Simons term is parity odd. Since parity is broken, it can be produced. And it is produced. And it has a coefficient or a level of opposite sign depending upon which vacuum you're in.
What was little n?
Little m is just something I invented for that equation. It's determined by the coupling constant. What really happens is that there's a critical coupling. What do they call it? G? If you plot G versus sigma, or sigma versus G, you'll find that there's a critical coupling. And you get event turning on above that critical coupling. So M is just determined by G and GC, just determined by where you are. Okay. So notice, so the reason that I'm talking about this theory in this context is that the Chern-Simons operator is a dimension 3 parity odd operator. So maybe it's the one that I found in this torsional theory. In fact, because of the production of this Chern-Simons term with different signs in the two vacua, if I write the action, then the effective action in one vacuum and compare it to the effective action in the other vacuum, I find that they're equal up to a shift of what I'm now, in respect of the previous transparency, I'll call 2 pi times O3. Okay, so I'm just rewriting this in sort of units appropriate to what we had before. But you can see, as you go from one vacuum to the other, the coupling of this operator normalized in this way is shifted by 2 pi. Okay, so that looks like it agrees with the shift of the coupling as you go from one vacuum to the other. But remember that the other piece of information we had about this theory was that this dimension 3 operator had a VEV of opposite sign in these two limits. And well, since parity is broken, I mean I don't think it's ever been computed, but presumably since parity is broken here, it's possible that a one-point function for this operator can be produced, presumably at the opposite sign in the two vacua. Although, as I said, I don't think that has actually been ever calculated. Okay. So anyway, so that is meant to be just sort of a toy model, which might capture the physics that we found in by holography of that torsion vortex. And so again, so the picture here is that we have a situation where there are two asymptotics, and apparently they have a dimension 3 operator which has opposite sign VEV in the two limits. Now, one thing that I haven't been careful about here, and in fact is something that I don't exactly understand yet, we're still trying to work this out, is the topology of the boundary. So one thing that you might have had in your mind is that, well, is it really true that I'm supposed to think of these two asymptotics as different? Or should I identify them? Or what should I do about that? And I think a nice picture of this is that you really should think about these as separate components of a boundary. And as I said, I don't know the complete answer here, but the picture is really determined by understanding the details of the topology of the boundary. So one thing that might happen is that you're actually supposed to not identify the entire boundaries, but perhaps you're supposed to glue them along infinity in both directions. Okay, and if that were the case, well, let me say, I think that's the case, but I'm not completely sure. But if that was the case, then the way to think about this boundary then is that the two asymptotic regions are really like, well, they're each a copy of R3, but they should be thought of as the two patches covering an S4. So that they're an S3. The boundary then would be, you could maybe think about it this way. The total boundary, the union of these things glued along their boundary would then be an S3. And then but remember that we have this operator with different VEV on each end. So the interpretation here would be that there's a domain wall separating two phases. The two possible phases, the two phases, the two parity, the opposite parity vacua of the boundary theory. So as I said, I'm not completely sure about that topology, but that's one nice interpretation, I think. So this torsion, this thing that is the torsion vortex from the bulk point of view would then have an interpretation as a domain wall separating parity, violating vacua. Okay, well, it turns out that there's also a sort of bulk interpretation, which I mentioned right at the beginning. And this is meant just to be, at least to begin, just to be sort of a fun analogy. And the analogy is the following. So let me just plot again the fields that we found in this torsion vortex. And this isn't quite the plot that I showed you before, but let me just plot the absolute value of H, which I guess I never said it, but that's A dot, the radial derivative of the field appearing in the metric. Okay? Well, okay, so when you do that, you get a plot which looks like this. And if you open any book on superconductivity, you'll immediately see that plot. Okay? So if we were talking about a 2+1 dimensional superconductor, you would see that plot. And in that case, the blue curve is the condensate, okay, which violates the gauge symmetry in the superconductor. And so asymptotically you have a condensate, just a constant condensate. And as you go in towards the center here, the condensate drops to zero. This is a picture of an Abrikosa vortex. Okay? And the core of that Abrikosa vortex just sits here. The condensate goes to zero at the core, and so that's where the normal phase, the non-superconducting phase, sits. And as you also know, that in a superconductor, the magnetic induction by the Meissner effect is not allowed to exist in the superconductor. And that, so it, far from the vortex, it goes off to zero. But within the vortex, you can have that magnetic induction turned on. And those are the important properties of the vortex. Okay. So if you just take this analog seriously, or somewhat seriously, and just run with it, you find the following. So if you look at so we have this exact solution. So we can just look at the asymptotics, right? The fields depend exponentially on the coordinate. And if you just do the math, what you find is that the magnetic field has what in superconductor analog is called a penetration length, lambda, and that goes like 1/3 A. And A here is, well, I've written the cosmological constant, capital lambda, is -3A². Okay, so it's A is like 1/80 S radius. Okay, and the other important piece of information here is that the order parameter has what's called a coherence length. Again, it's just set by the exponential fall off, often called C, and that goes like 1/6 A. Okay, furthermore, if you look at the equation of motion, so the Einstein equation, and if I just take a derivative of the Einstein equation, I can manipulate them into this form, okay, where again, remember H was A dot, the radial derivative of the metric function. And so the equation of motion can be written in this form. And so what it looks like is the equation of motion for a phi-4 theory, right? And so that looks like a Landau-Ginzburg equation, which is an important equation in superconductors. And if you make the comparison, in the superconductor Landau-Ginzburg equation, the coefficient of the mass term is nothing but T minus TC. There. And so lambda here, the cosmological constant in this analogy, is playing the role of T minus TC. That's kind of bizarre. But if you rewrite, if you relate lambda to A, as I told you about a moment ago, you find that the penetration length and coherence length scale like the square root of T minus TC, and those are characteristic of such a phase transition from the superconducting phase to the normal. Okay, so let's push this even further. And so as I said, the torsion vortex appears to be just an analogy of the Abrikosov vortex. The properties of it are very similar. The one thing that you should notice, though, is that this is the problem with calling this a torsion vortex rather than say a kink. The codimensions are different. Okay, and that's sort of represented in these pictures here that I've drawn at the bottom. But anyway, let's keep pushing the analogy further. And what you find in a very simple way is that this, in fact, is a type 1 superconductor. Now, to tell the difference between type 1 and type 2, what you need to do is to look, or one way to do it, is to look at the vortices. So consider, say, a solution with two vortices and try to understand whether they attract or repel each other. Okay, well, I don't have an exact, just as in the superconductor case, I don't have an exact solution corresponding to two vortices. But if we simply put two vortices in at a distance L and compute the energy of that configuration, you'll find that it's non-zero. And hence, there's a force between those vortices, which turns out to be negative. Okay, so that means that they attract each other. And so what happens in this analog then is that vortices tend to clump together. They're attracted together. And if you had many of them, well, because the normal phase is at the core of the vortex, what you tend to get is a clump or a bubble or a droplet of normal phase which within the superconductor. Okay, and there's a critical magnetic field here which just corresponds to the place where the transition has gone all of the way, and the entire space, the entire region is filled up with the normal phase. Okay, well, remember, okay, so here's a picture of the same thing, but in the torsion vortex case, we only have this one direction here. Remember that in the torsion vortex case, what I mean by normal phase, what's at the core of the torsion vortex is a transverse section which is flat. Okay, so that's in this analogy what I mean by the normal phase in the superconductor here is really like flat space. Okay. And another sort of calculation that is a standard calculation in the superconductor case is to consider what happens when we have many vortices within the sample. As I said, they tend to attract one another and form droplets. Okay. And what happens is that if you apply an external magnetic field, so that's what I was drawing here, if you apply an external magnetic field, just a uniform field, you'll find that magnetic field can't go through the superconducting region, but it can go through, that's what the vortex does, it allows the field to pass through. And each vortex carries a quantum of flux. So if I turn up some finite external magnetic field, then, what you'll find is that there's a droplet formed of a certain size, which depends on the value of the magnetic field. Okay, so the analog in the torsion vortex case is that this external field is playing the role of the magnetic field is in fact the H flux or the torsion. Okay, and so to study the size of such a droplet that would form, what you need to do is to consider a multi-vortex configuration and calculate what the preferred configuration is by energy considerations. And one can do this in this case because you have the exact form of the single vortex solution, and all we're doing is we're just sort of putting them side by side. Okay, so what happens is if you do that calculation, so suppose I take n vortices in a box of size L0, okay, and I should have mentioned that I'm putting a cutoff on the in the radial direction, it's just the usual cutoff that we do in ADS-CFT at some finite distance in the asymptotic direction. So here I have two asymptotics, so I cut off on both ends, and so the radial direction has size 2L in these coordinates. Okay, so let me take, as I was saying, consider the case where I have n vortices in a box of size L naught. And let me ask, for a given magnetic field, how big that droplet is. Okay. So as I said, this is sort of a standard calculation that you can do for superconductors. And what you find, if you compute the energy, is that it's preferential for there to be many, many vortices. Okay, and it asymptotes to some finite energy, but n wants to go off to a very large amount. And if you then plot the size of this region versus n, you find that in that region, that's asymptoting to a fixed value. So you get a fixed value of the size of the droplet, which is preferred by the energy considerations. You do the arithmetic and you find this result, where again, h here is this external H flux that's being applied. Okay, so the interpretation here then, if you just use this analogy to the end, is that in the presence of H flux, if you take all of this torsion vortex interpretation seriously, and this analog seriously, then you find that apparently the system would prefer to have a finite size droplet of normal phase. And in this case, that's flat space. So I have many vortices sort of smeared over a finite region, and each vortex has a flat transverse, is flat transversely. Okay, and that's all sitting within asymptotically ADS, in asymptotically ADS geometry. And there's a critical H flux apparently where, at least if I fix the cutoff and ramp up the H flux, eventually I'll get to the point where the system wants to fill the entire space-time. Okay, good. So let me just conclude. What we found is an interesting exact solution of gravity plus torsion. It has these, it has two asymptotic regions. The bulk solution, as I drew it here, is somewhat like it's sort of reminiscent of a wormhole-like geometry connecting two asymptotically ADS regions. And holographically, the interpretation, as I described, has this interpretation in terms of parity violating vacua. Okay. And let me remind you that in this analogy that I talked about at the end, it was the cosmological constant which was playing the role of T minus TC, right? And the normal phase, which you get to above the critical, well, you get driven towards lambda equals zero, which is the normal phase as T goes towards TC in a sense. I don't really have any, I don't have any dynamical, I don't have anything more than I've shown you. I don't have any dynamical interpretation here other than this analogy. So I'm not really sure what this will, this mean. So a couple of additional open problems here is you might ask, is there a boundary view of this superconductor analogy? Can I see this, in the boundary in some way? Another thing that you might think about is you might remember this is in Euclidean ADS, and you might ask, could I apply it to other signatures? Maybe you can do this in De Sitter, for example. Of course, there's all the usual problems with the interpretation of De Sitter CFT, but this might give us a new viewpoint on that. And well, we haven't gone much into that, but just a couple of comments. One is that for the solution to exist in the form that I gave it, the total signature has to be positive. So that's why I went to Euclidean ADS. If I want to do something like De Sitter, I have to do a double Wick rotation in order to find solutions of the same sort. Anyway, if you do that and you look at the sort of the analog of the details I've shown you, it turns out that that's a type 2 superconductor rather than a type 1. Those vortices repel each other rather than attract. OK, so that's all I have to say about that at the moment.
I don't quite understand what you mean, like, say, overall signature. I mean, if you, so, I mean, you've got to have, you say there is no solution with one minus and the rest plus?
That's right. You get.
So there are, does that mean there are solutions with two minus?
Those, I guess those are more like the standard wormhole solutions. That's right. So what I was talking about here is the radial direction in DeSitter is time-like. And so in order to get a solution of the form that I gave, then what we would have to do is have one of the boundaries, one of the transverse directions be time-like as well.
So two time-like directions.
It would have two time-like directions. So yeah. That's, you know, it's gonna be hard to interpret what that means.
More questions?
Try one more then. Why? I mean, you said you weren't sure if you had to identify in that way. What makes you not sure? Like, I'm torn between thinking, why should you do it at all? Or if you think you could do it, what's the instruction?
I'm just hesitating because I tried to do the calculation. I just started it last week, so I haven't convinced myself that we did it correctly.
But what compels you to make this identification? I mean, is it necessary in some sense?
No, I don't think it's necessary. It might, in fact, not be the right interpretation, but I guess in my mind I was sort of worried that there were these two asymptotic regions, and you know, the natural question is you know, I have two asymptotic regions, there's not a horizon between them, you know, so what, I sort of have to take them both at the same time, apparently, but I just thought that if, the idea was is that if the topology is as I drew there, then it has a more, it has a more down-to-earth field theory interpretation, I guess. Now, what I should say is that this isn't really a domain wall. And I guess I should have added this to a slide, but this isn't really a domain wall. It's more like a mirror. In the sense that if you considered some fluctuation of a bulk field out near one of the asymptotics, okay, and really, so suppose you just take the exact torsion vortex solution and solve the linearized wave equation around that background for some field, say a scalar field or something. What you'll find is that such a field would, you know, behave in some way out near one of the asymptotics, but that would be correlated with the way the scalar field behaves over at the other asymptotic. The issue here is that this is, if I draw the analog in ADS, you know, what we usually do in ADS, if I talk about a propagating scalar field on ADS, we normally apply a boundary condition, right, in the interior, and we find, you know, we get the usual interpretation of the asymptotics of that scalar field out there. In this case, I don't have anything going on in the interior of this geometry. It doesn't look natural to apply any sort of boundary condition. So instead, what I would do is I would apply boundary conditions at one of the other ends in order to determine a solution. And generically, if you have some fluctuation over here, you'll find that there's a fluctuation over on the other side. So so that's what I was saying, you shouldn't really think of it as a domain wall, because if I have something going on in this vacuum over here, then there's a mirror image of that, in a sense, in this holographic sense, to something going on over there. So there aren't separate probes on the two ends. That probably had nothing to do with the question you were asking.
No.
Anyway, that's more detail.
More questions? Okay, then let's thank the speaker again.